Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment, we're going to continue our update of events pertinent to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. In particular, in this segment, we're going to take a look at the apparent efforts on the part of elements of U.S. intelligence and the U.S. far right to paint Lee Harvey Oswald red. There is considerable evidence that, in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald was a U.S. intelligence operative who was given a left cover for purpose or purposes as yet to be determined. There are a number of theories in this particular regard. It then appears that fascist elements within the U.S. national security establishment, acting in conjunction with fascist elements in Europe, Latin America, and Asia, then utilized Lee Harvey Oswald, an apparent left-cover U.S. intelligence operative, as a patsy in order to effect the assassination of President Kennedy and to effect a cover-up by the U.S. government as a whole in order to avoid compromising U.S. national security methodology. Again, I do not think that the CIA, per se, killed President Kennedy. I don't think that that agency had the power or intent, but I think there were elements of the CIA as well as elements of FBI and other U.S. national security agencies that were involved with the assassination as a part of this fascist cabal, and that necessitated a cover-up by the U.S. government as a whole. In particular, we're going to take a look at the possibility of Lee Harvey Oswald as a left-cover intelligence dangle, so to speak, possibly intended to root out a Soviet mole involved with U.S. intelligence in order to discover more about the U-2 project, the CIA's top-secret spy plane. Another possibility concerns Lee Harvey Oswald's operations in New Orleans as part of a CIA operation to neutralize the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole member of the New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, whose addresses were shared with the Guy Bannister Detective Agency, an ultra-right-wing detective agency and apparent intelligence front that was involved with U.S. intelligence's guerrilla war efforts against Fidel Castro. In fact, that same building had housed the New Orleans offices of the CRC, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban umbrella organization. Once again, we're going to examine a couple of items from an article entitled Oswald and the CIA by Dick Russell. This article was in the High Times magazine's issue of March of 1996, and research credit on this goes to a listener. Of the book by John Newman, Oswald and the CIA, and the possibility that Oswald may have been a CIA dangle to root out a Soviet mole with regard to the U-2 project, Russell writes, "Also pertinent in Newman's tracing of earlier CIA interest in Oswald, from the moment the ex-Marine showed up at the American Embassy in Moscow trying to renounce his citizenship in October of 1959, quote, I was particularly interested, unquote, Newman says, again quoting, in trying to marshal evidence for Oswald having been a counterintelligence dangle. In other words, the CIA would have been using him to ferret out a mole who was first thought to be in the U-2 program before the focus very quickly changed to their own Soviet Russia division. A, quote, mole, unquote, is a hidden asset of the KGB, such as Aldrich Ames, observing the then top-secret U-2 spy plane program was part of Oswald's mission while a Marine in Japan. Newman observes that the, quote, most pronounced fingerprints, unquote, on Oswald emanated from the CIA's mole-hunting unit, CI/SIG, run by the late super spook James Jesus Angleton. The existence of Soviet moles inside the CIA was among Nagel's key points about the assassination. He indicated that John Paisley, who was in charge of a CIA unit overseeing Soviet electronics at the time Oswald was employed in a radio electronics factory in Minsk, and who died mysteriously in 1978, was one such mole. Nagel also hinted that his own case officer inside the Mexico City station had nefarious ties to Soviet intelligence, which he himself did not discover until the late summer of 1963. This is not to say that the Soviets were behind the assassination, a theory that Nagel adamantly repudiated, but rather that the CIA hierarchy cover-up of its relations with Oswald related to its ultra-secret mole hunt. And still later in the article, Dick Russell discusses another possible use for Lee Harvey Oswald as a left-cover intelligence operative. Skipping down, we read, we also know that, as early as February of 1961, Phillips, that's David Atlee Phillips, the CIA's covert action chief in Mexico City, continuing, was supervising a CIA operation against the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, a one-man chapter of which Oswald established in New Orleans in the summer of 1963. Phillips was working in tandem with James McCord, a CIA agent later involved in the Watergate scandal. As far back as 1976, both Phillips and McCord were cited in cryptic comments by Richard Nagel as having played some role in the CIA's relationship with Oswald. What we're going to do next is to listen to a segment of The Guns of November, Part 1. That is the first part of a four-part documentary, archive documentary, that I put together in November of 1983 on the occasion of the 20th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. What you're going to hear is not only the Lee Harvey Oswald interview with radio station WDSU in New Orleans, but also the circumstances surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans. Now, bear in mind that this interview was arranged by Ed Butler, who was working for the Information Council for the Americas, a right-wing propaganda outfit with numerous apparent intelligence connections. The head of INCA was Dr. Alton Oxner, an individual who figured prominently in the six-part interview that I did with Ed Haslam, the author of Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, a remarkable book about the Kennedy assassination, discussing possible connections between the assassination and the development of AIDS, and a cancer epidemic that is now sweeping, the soft tissue cancer epidemic now sweeping the United States. And again, interested listeners are referred to that series. We're going to listen now to a segment of The Guns of November, Part 1, recorded on November 1st, 1983. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
Now, recall how when we dealt with the Francis Gary Powers book, Operation Overflight, Powers was the first of many to intimate that Lee Harvey Oswald was basically a Soviet sympathizer or agent who was responsible for downing the U-2 and consequently scotching the summit conference between Khrushchev and Eisenhower. Now, Oswald did indeed emigrate to the Soviet Union. While in the Soviet Union, he got a job at a radio factory, was interviewed by a number of people in the U.S. Embassy, all of whom later turned out to be CIA officials, or agents, I should say. And then, despite the fact that he had supposedly committed treason against the United States and espionage by revealing top-secret information on North American air defenses as well as the U-2's radar situation, that he then encountered remarkably little difficulty in getting back into the United States. He did this, the action of getting Oswald back into the U.S. was initiated through a letter to Texas Senator John Tower, who became chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And Oswald got back into the United States, was never indicted or prosecuted for his espionage, and was able to move about the United States rather freely. Now, one of the interesting things is that Lee Harvey Oswald began work on behalf of Fidel Castro, or at least allegedly so. He became not only the head of, but the sole member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, New Orleans chapter, and as it turned out, he was the only member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, New Orleans chapter, but he was not the only person who hung around their headquarters.
Let me stress also this point that Dave is making. Now, on one level, now remember out there, those of you who are not so familiar with some of the subject matter that we're talking about or with the dealings of intelligence, it is very important to remember that the key thing going on here is the difference between reality and appearance. And in this case, Lee Harvey Oswald, who defected to the Soviet Union claiming that he was going to give away all of America's top secret information on air defense and things of this nature, went to Russia, came back, and as a matter of fact, in the process of moving back, I believe he even received a $400 loan from somebody in the government through the State Department to enable him to finish up his affairs and to be able to get back to the United States. When he came into the country, he was never what's called a post-situational interview. He was never debriefed. Thank you very much. He was never debriefed. As a matter of fact, the only person out to meet this heinous defector who'd gone to the Soviet Union, our Cold War enemy, in pitched battle to give them all of our air secrets, the only man out to meet him was a gentleman by the name of Spaz T. Rakin, who was theoretically was a representative of Traveler's Aid, but was in fact a representative of several Eastern European violently, almost fanatically anti-communist groups who came out in a very friendly manner to meet this Soviet defector, this pro-Castro, pro-Russian defector, instead of any kind of government official who might want to know what Lee Harvey Oswald had talked to the Soviets about while he was in Russia.
It's interesting, too, that Oswald, the supposed leftist, associated with an enormous number of right-wing people. Now, something we're going to talk about next week and in weeks to come concerns the fact that the address for Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee, recall he was its only member, opened on... It basically was in a building which had another entrance on a different street. One was 544 Camp Street and one was 541 Lafayette Place in New Orleans. I can never remember which was which. Which was the head of the, which was the headquarters of the so-called Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and which was an office of a former FBI agent and ultra-right winger named Guy Bannister.
544 Camp Street was the address on Oswald's literature. And again, we're talking about appearance versus reality. Lee Harvey Oswald has had a series of handbills printed up that said he the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, of which he was only the treasurer supposedly, and it had an address of 544 Camp Street. In reality, he may have been the treasurer, he also would have had to have been the president, the vice president, all the members, because as Dave said, he was the only member. And 542 Lafayette Street was the address kitty-cornered. In other words, it was a building on a corner. One corner was 544 Camp Street. The door on the other corner was 542 Lafayette Street. They both led up to a first-floor landing, and the office space shared on that first-floor landing with Lee Harvey Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee was the offices of a detective who was a former FBI agent who had many contacts with the anti-Castro Cuban crowd and the Bay of Pigs crowd by the name of Guy Bannister.
None of that, but Guy Bannister was affiliated with Division 5 of the FBI, which is the Internal Security Division. Now, Oswald got in a very highly publicized street altercation with a guy named Carlos Bringuier, who is a Cuban exile affiliated with CIA. And this resulted eventually in an on-air interview between Oswald and a couple of individuals that Nip Tuck is going to tell you about. And this is interesting because this interview certainly laid the groundwork for representing Oswald as a communist sympathizer, if not indeed a Soviet agent, whereas... The official version of the Warren Commission's thesis, the Warren Commission thesis was that Oswald was a lone nut. And when the facts of the situation are examined, Oswald's contacts appear to be overwhelmingly not only right, but far right. And it's worth noting here that there was a definite and apparently deliberate effort to represent Oswald as a leftist and to achieve a great deal of publicity with this effort.
Okay, I'm going to be reading from a book entitled Conspiracy. It's by Anthony Summers. It was published in 1980 by McGraw-Hill Books. As a matter of fact, got a lot of very good reviews when it came out, a very scholarly book on the subject of Lee Harvey Oswald and his intelligence contacts.
Summers is a BBC reporter who was commissioned by the BBC to undertake its investigation of the Kennedy assassination.
All right. Once again, reading from Conspiracy and talking first and foremost about a man named Carlos Bringuier, with whom Lee Harvey Oswald had a very publicized shoving match, which enabled him to become known in media circles as a Marxist, because of course then he was dragged onto radio programs and interviewed by newspaper reporters, because somebody who was willing to go out in public and hand out handbills for Castro in those days was quite a bit more visible than they would be these days. So once again, that's the first person we're going to be talking about, is this anti-Castro Cuban by the name of Carlos Bringuier, and I read from Summers' book as follows. Carlos Bringuier, the exile in the New Orleans clash with Oswald, certainly had contact with the CIA. He was a New Orleans delegate of the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, the outgrowth of a militant Cuban student group. The group had naturally been deeply involved with the CIA at the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion, and continued to receive funds afterward. The Assassinations Committee found that Bringuier had reported his contact with Oswald to his group's headquarters in Miami, and that the information had in turn been relayed to the CIA. A document obtained from the agency, that's from the CIA itself, reveals that the CIA had, quote, passed contact with Carlos Bringuier. Contact was limited to domestic service activities, unquote. As we noted in the case of George de Morenschild's CIA contacts, the Domestic Contacts Division is best known for its efforts to obtain information from travelers returning from communist countries. However, CIA spokesmen have in the past confused inquirers by using that title rather than, quote, Domestic Operations Division. the clandestine department, which by 1963 was conducting secret operations within the United States. Let me go back and just restate that real quickly. The agency's own memos revealed that they had had past contacts with Carlos Bringier, which they claimed the contact was limited to domestic service activities. However, and I quote again from Summers, CIA spokesmen have in the past confused inquirers by using that title, namely domestic services, rather than domestic operations division. The clandestine department, which by 1963 was conducting secret operations within the United States. Carlos Bringier, as New Orleans head of the DRE, also published a right-wing news sheet backed by the Crusade to Free Cuba Committee. The committee was funded by the CIA. It turns out that the agency's fingerprints mark every stage of the process by which Oswald was exposed as a communist. Very little about that, it seems, was spontaneous. First, Carlos Bringier called William Stuckey, a young reporter who had a weekly radio program on station WDSU. Stuckey went to see Oswald and found him a clean-cut, articulate figure, quite the opposite of the unkempt, wild-looking left-wing prototype he had anticipated. After recording and broadcasting the initial interview, one which he would later recall as oddly, quote, deliberate, Stuckey then began planning a follow-up debate program. What ensued was a classic case of media manipulation for political profit. Stuckey found himself positively showered with information guaranteed to smear Oswald. First, there was a telephone conversation with either the head or the deputy head of the local FBI office, who obligingly read out aloud large extracts from Oswald's file. Thus did Stuckey learn of Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union. Soon, the industrious Bringier popped up again, eager to impress similar information on the reporter. He said he had obtained it by sending an anti-Castro colleague to see Oswald, posing as a Castro sympathizer. Finally, the same day, Stuckey received a phone call from Edward Butler, director of a right-wing propaganda information called the Information Council of the Americas, or INCA, I-N-C-A. Butler confided that after telephone calls to Washington, he had confirmed Oswald's Soviet connections with, quote, someone at the House Un-American Activities Committee. The very title, Council of the Information Council of the Americas, speaks volumes for its origins and allegiances. At the time of the Oswald revelations, its manager was a member of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the anti-Castro government in exile created by the CIA.
Okay, now we're in just a second going to play you the interview, a tape of the interview that was conducted by Jim Stuckey, Ed Butler, and Carlos Bringier with Lee Harvey Oswald on WDSU. Now, before we get into the tape, two details that I'd like to call to your attention, two things to pay close attention to. First of all, in the very beginning of the interview, Lee Harvey Oswald is going to be asked a question about his status, about the status of his citizenship while in the Soviet Union, and his reply is very halting. He stutters, but he initially says that at all times while in the Soviet Union, he was under the protection of the United States government, and then he quickly... He hems and haws and backtracks and negates that.
Now, again, just to clue you into this stuff, because it all goes by rather quickly, a very odd thing for somebody to say, or even to claim any kind of connection with the U.S. government, for somebody who has supposedly and purportedly defected to the Soviet Union because of his disgust with the United States and with the avowed purpose of giving away America's military secrets.
Also, take note of the fact that Carlos Bringier, right, the member of the DRE, the CIA-sponsored Cuban student group, that Carlos Bringier asks a very provocative question to Lee Harvey Oswald. He mentions that Castro characterized President Kennedy as a ruffian and a thief, then asks Lee Harvey Oswald whether he agrees with Castro's characterization of Kennedy. This is worth noting because the tape of this interview that we're going to play was broadcast all over the United States the evening of the assassination. So basically what you're about to hear was heard by all of America on the evening that JFK was assassinated.
All right. So once again, this is William Stuckey's radio interview, and the participants are the people that we have outlined. Carlos Bringier, anti-Castro Cuban with CIA contacts. Ed Butler, a very prominent right-winger, later with contacts to the John Birch Society and other groups, also with CIA contacts. And Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of John F. Kennedy.
Stuckey and I are talking with three guests, Lee Harvey Oswald, who is local secretary of a group called Fair Play for Cuba, and with Ed Butler, the executive director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Bringer, a Cuban refugee and obviously anti-Castro. Mr. Oswald, as you might imagine, is on the hot seat tonight, and I believe, Bill Stuckey, you have a question for him.
Yes, Mr. Oswald, I believe you said in reply to a question from Mr. Butler that any questions about your background were extraneous to the discussion tonight. I disagree because of the fact that you refused to reveal any of the other members of your organization, so you are the face of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans. Therefore, anybody who might be interested in this organization ought to know more about you. For this reason, I'm curious to know just how you supported yourself during the 3 years that you lived in the Soviet Union. Did you have a government subsidy?
I will answer that question directly then, since you will not rest until you get your answer. I worked in Russia. I was under the protection of I was not under the protection of the American government, but that is, I was at all times considered an American citizen. I did not lose my American citizenship.
Did you say you wanted to at one point, though, or what happened?
Well, it's a long, drawn-out situation in which permission to live in the Soviet Union granted to a foreign resident is very rarely given. This requires a certain amount of technicalities, technical papers, and so forth. At no time, as I say, did I renounce my citizenship or attempt to renounce my citizenship, and at no time was I out of contact or with the American embassy.
May I interrupt just 1 second? Either one of these two statements is wrong. The Washington Evening Star of October 31st, 1959, page 1, reported that Lee Harvey Oswald, a former Marine of 4936 Collingwood Street, Fort Worth, Texas, had turned in his passport at the American Embassy in Moscow on that same date and had said that he had applied for Soviet citizenship. Now, this seems to me that you've renounced your American citizenship if you've turned in your passport.
Well, the very obvious answer to that is that I'm back in the United States. A person who renounces his citizenship becomes legally disqualified for returning to the United States.
Right, and Soviet authorities, this is from the Washington Post and Times Herald of November 16, 1959, Soviet authorities had refused to grant it, although they had informed him that he could live in Russia as a resident alien. What did you do during the 2 weeks from October 31st to November 16, 1959?
As I've already stated, of course, this is a whole conversation, and we don't have too much time left, is getting away from the Cuban-American problem. However, I'm quite willing to discuss myself for the remainder of this program. As I have stated, it is very difficult for a resident, for a foreigner, to get permission to reside in the Soviet Union. During those 2 weeks and during the date that you mentioned, I was, of course, with the knowledge of the American embassy, getting this permission.
Were you ever in a building at 11 Kuznetskaya Street in Moscow?
Kuznetskaya?
Mm-hmm.
Kuznetskaya is the, well, that would be probably the foreign ministry, I assume. No, I was never in that place, although I know Moscow, having lived there.
Mr. Butler, let me interrupt, and I think Mr. Oswald is right to this extent. We should get around to the organization which he is ahead of here in New Orleans, Fair Play for Cuba.
Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
As a practical matter, Mr. Oswald, knowing, as you, I'm sure you do, the sentiment in America against Cuba, we, of course, severed diplomatic relations some time ago. I would say Castro is about as unpopular as anybody in the world in this country. As a practical matter, what do you hope to gain through your work? How do you hope to bring about what you call fair play for Cuba, knowing the sentiment?
The principles of the fair play for Cuba consist of restoration of diplomatic trade and tourist relations with Cuba. That is one of our main points. We are for that. I disagree that this situation regarding American-Cuban relations is very unpopular. We are in a minority, surely. We are, however, not particularly interested in what Cuban exiles or rightist members of rightist organizations have to say. We are primarily interested in the attitude of the United States government toward Cuba. And in that way, we are striving to get the United States to adopt measures which would be more friendly toward the Cuban people and the new Cuban regime in that country. We are not at all communist-controlled. regardless of the fact that I have the experience of living in Russia, regardless of the fact that we have been investigated, regardless of any of those facts, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee is an independent organization, not affiliated with any other organization. Our aims and our ideals are very clear and in the best keeping with American traditions of democracy.
Do you agree with Fidel Castro when he, in his last speech of July 26 of this year, he qualified President John Fitzgerald Kennedy of the United States as a ruffian and a thief? Do you agree with Mr. Castro?
I would not agree. I would not agree with that particular wording. However, I and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee does think that the United States government, through certain agencies, namely the State Department and the CIA, has made monumental mistakes in its relations with Cuba, mistakes which are pushing Cuba into the sphere of activity of, let's say, a very dogmatic communist country as China is.
Mr. Oswald, would you agree that when Castro first took power, would you agree that the United States was very friendly with Castro, that the people of this country had nothing but admiration for him, that they were very glad to see Batista thrown out?
I would say that the activities of the United States government in regard to Batista were a manifestation of not so much support for Fidel Castro, but rather a withdrawal of support from Batista. In other words, we stopped armaments to Batista. What we should have done was to take those armaments and drop them into the Sierra Maestra, where Fidel Castro could have used them. As for public sentiment at that time, I think even at that time, even before the revolution, there were rumblings of official comment and so forth from government officials against Fidel Castro.
You've never been to Cuba, of course, but why are the people in Cuba starving today?
Well, in any country emerging from a semi-colonial state and embarking upon reforms which require a diversification of agriculture, you're going to have shortages. After all, 80% of imports into the United States from Cuba were two products, tobacco and sugar. Nowadays, while Cuba is reducing its product as far as sugarcane goes, it is striving to grow unlimited and unheard of for Cuba quantities of certain vegetables, sweet potatoes, lima beans, cotton, and so forth, so that they can become agriculturally independent.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to interrupt. Our time is almost up. We've had three guests tonight on Conversation Carte Blanche. Bill Stuckey and I have been talking with Lee Harvey Oswald, Secretary of the New Orleans Chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, Ed Butler, Executive Director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Brignere, a Cuban refugee. Thank you very much, and good evening.
All right, and that was the voice of Lee Harvey Oswald, as well as the others introduced. And some rather interesting things that we pointed out before, which we hope you got a chance to catch, and some rather interesting things set up for all time. And one, again, cannot help but notice the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald, a communist, supposed communist with no organization whatsoever, managed to make his Marxist sympathies and his relationship to the Castro regime and the Russian government awfully well known for a man with a committee of one.
Keep in mind that this interview was in August of 1963, about 3 months before Kennedy was killed, and it was aired, as we said, the evening of the assassination. Everybody heard what you just heard, and, well, what conclusions do you think they were supposed to draw?
That again from The Guns of November, Part 1, from November 1st of 1983. That concludes the segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.